This is a podcast from meow.net.
Meow!
Meanwhile, on an abandoned bookshelf.
Hello and welcome to what will be the last episode in this series of The Abandoned Bookshelf. My name's Owen Kelly. In the last episode, I looked at Tools for Conviviality by Ivan Illich, a book to which I return again and again. In this episode, this final episode, I'm going to look at John McKnight's book from 1995, The Curless Society, Community and Its Counterfeits. This ties directly into the previous episode, and I'm going to explain how it does that in a second. But let's start by asking who John McKnight is and what he's done that makes him interesting to us as we think about cultural democracy and the commons. John McKnight was born in Ohio, a travelling Ohioan, in his words. He lived in seven neighbourhoods and small towns in the 18 years before he left to attend university, Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois. When he returned to Chicago, he began working for several activist organisations, including the Chicago Commission for Human Relations, which was the first municipal civil rights agency. This was followed by the directorship of the Illinois American Civil Liberties Union, where he organised local chapters throughout the state. When John Kennedy was elected president, John McKnight was recruited into the federal government, where he worked with a new agency creating the Affirmative Action Program. Later, he was appointed the Midwest Director of the United States Commission on Civil Rights, where he worked with local civil rights and neighborhood organizations. In the 1970s, John McKnight and his colleague Jody Kreutzmann focused their research on urban neighborhoods. The best-known result of this work was a formulation of an understanding of neighborhoods that focused on the usefulness of local resources, local capacities, and local relationships. This work was documented in a guide titled Building Communities from the Inside Out, which described an approach to community building that became a major development strategy across large parts of the world. After The Curless Society, Community and Its Counterfeits, McKnight wrote The Abundant Community, Awakening the Power of Families and Neighbourhoods, with Peter Block, which explored the riches in neighbourhoods and small towns. He also wrote An Other Kingdom, Departing the Consumer Culture, with Peter Block and Walter Brueggemann, and this explored the nature of community life outside the consumer society. McKnight co-founded the Health and Medical Policy Research Group with Dr. Quentin Young, co-founded the Gamaliel Foundation with Greg Galuzzo, and was a founding board member of the National People's Action led by Gail Kinkota. He's currently on the board of Communities First Association, the Abundant Community Initiative, and the Asset-Based Community Development Institute. The latter I will come back to later in this discussion. As a young man, McKnight learnt directly from Ivan Illich. Indeed, he's mentioned at the beginning of Tools for Conviviality in a long list of thanks and acknowledgements. He's thanked for his work at CDOC. McKnight himself refers to this at the beginning of the Curless Society. He says, Ivan Illich was a man of great brilliance, perspective and heart, and he adopted me. On our journey, I was an intellectual waif, but he patiently told me the stories of our past that explained the present and predicted the future. In the years after this, McKnight has trodden a very different path to Ivan Illich. As I noted in the previous episode, Illich appeared to decide to identify the problems and describe them as clearly as he could, without distracting himself by thinking how they might be solved, especially how they might be solved in the Northern Hemisphere. He believed, or at least he appeared to believe, that Europe and America had just simply gone too far down the wrong road to be saved. And so he focused on South America and other places where he believed there was still hope. Hope, that is, of going around the mess that industrialization and the introduction of radical monopolies had wreaked upon Europe and America. McKnight, on the other hand, has remained an optimist and asks himself, what can we do here? He shares much of Illich's analysis, but he has a burning desire to find solutions that will work for the people he knows in the places where he and they live. He begins the book by describing the problems of professionalism. He argues that professionalism is, as Illich says, counterproductive. He says we can assess the degree of impediment incorporated in modern service technologies by weighing four basic elements. The first is the monetary cost. At what point do the economics of a service technology consume enough of the commonwealth that all society becomes eccentric and distorted? Shoemaker, in his book Small is Beautiful, helped us to recognise the radical social and political distortions created by huge investments in covering our land with concrete in the name of transportation. Similarly, we are now investing 12% of our national wealth in healthcare technology that blankets most of our communities with a medicalised understanding of well-being. As a result, we now imagine there are mutant human beings called health consumers. We create costly health-making environments that are usually large windowless rooms filled with immobile adult bicycles and dreadfully heavy objects that are purported to benefit one if they are lifted up and down. The second element to be weighed was identified by Ivan Illich as specific counterproductivity. Beyond the negative side effect is the possibility that the service technology can produce the specific inverse of its stated purpose. Thus one can imagine medicine that makes one sick, schools that make their pupils stupid, and prison systems that teach prisoners crime. The evidence is growing that some service technologies are now so counterproductive that their abolition is the most productive means to achieve the goal for which they were initially established. The third element to be weighed is the loss of knowledge. Many of the settlers who came to Wisconsin had been peasant farmers in Europe. There they had tilled the land for centuries using methods that replenished its nourishing capacity. However, once the land seemed unlimited and John Deere's new steel ploughs became the dominant technology, the European settlers forgot the tools and methods that had sustained them for centuries in the old land and created a new desert. The fourth we need to weigh is the hidden curriculum of the service technologies. As they're implemented through professional techniques, the invisible message of the interaction between professional and client is, you will be better because I know better. As these professional techniques proliferate across the social landscape, they represent a new praxis, an ever-growing pedagogy that teaches this basic message of the service technologies. Through the propagation of belief in authoritative expertise, professionals cut through the social fabric of community and so clienthood, where citizenship once grew. He goes on to talk about the importance of defining and the importance of labelling and who does the labelling. He says that revolutions begin when people who are defined as problems achieve the power to redefine the problem. A critical point in the development of the civil rights struggle was the black movement's capacity to declare the central issue the white problem. A people declared deficient and in need, unshackled their labels, and attempted to lock them on their oppressor. There's a revolutionary insight in that strategy. It recognised that the power to label people deficient and declare them in need is the basic tool of control and oppression in modern industrialised societies, whether democratic or totalitarian in persuasion. The agents with comprehensive labelling power in these societies are the helping professionals. Their badge bestows the caring authority to declare their fellow citizens clients, a class of people in need by definition. This leads to the replacement of politics as civil discourse, with politics as consumer choice. McKnight answers these overwhelming issues by claiming that the answer lies in regenerating and rebuilding community. What, he asks, do we mean by community? There is no universally accepted definition. However, one is so practically useful that it can become central to the work of those concerned with the incorporation of labelled people into community life. I'm referring to an understanding laid out by Alexis de Tocqueville, the French count who visited the United States in 1831. What he found was that European settlers were creating a society different from the one they knew in Europe. Communities were forming around an uncustomary social invention, small groups of common citizens coming together to form organisations that solve problems. Tocqueville observed that these three features in how these groups operated. First, they were groups of citizens who decided they had the power to decide what was a problem. Secondly, they decided they had the power to decide how to solve the problem. Thirdly, they often decided that they themselves would become the key actors in implementing the solution. From Tocqueville's perspective, these citizen associations were a uniquely powerful instrument being created in America, the foundation stones of American communities. Now, it should seem obvious that communities are collective associations. They're more than and different from a series of friendships. One can have a friendship, for example, with a labelled person in an institution. But that does not mean that person has been incorporated into the community. A community is more than just a place. It consists of various groups of people who work together on a face-to-face basis in public life, not just in private. The kinds of associations that express and create community take several forms. Many of them are relatively formal, with names and with officers elected by members. They may be the American Legion, the local bowling league, or the local peace fellowship. A second kind of association is not so formal. It usually has no officers or even no name. Nonetheless, it represents a gathering of citizens who solve problems, celebrate together, or enjoy their social compact. These associations might be a poker club, a coffee clatch, or a gathering of neighbours who live on the block. The fact that they do not have a formal name and structure should not obscure the fact that they are often the site of critical dialogue, opinion formation, and decision-making that influence the values and problem-solving capacities of citizens. Indeed, many Americans are primarily influenced in their decision-making and value formation by these kinds of informal groups. A third form of association is less obvious, because one could describe the place where it occurs as an enterprise or business. However, much associational activity takes place in restaurants, beauty parlours, barbershops, bars, hardware stores, and other places of business. So-called third places, we might note. People gather in these places for interaction as well as transaction. In the 18th century, some of the most basic discussions about the formation of the government of the United States and its constitution occurred in inns and taverns, and similar settings provide the backdrop for some of the most fundamental associative life today. These three kinds of associations represent the community from which most people, labelled people, are excluded and into which they need to be incorporated if they are to become active citizens at the associational centre of a democratic society. In talking about labelled people in this part of the book, he's referring to people in mental health institutes. But he goes on to look at the American justice system and the American prison service industry and notes the similarities there and the way community has been replaced with a coercive service industry. In doing this, he builds upon the ideas of Saul Alinsky, who wrote about community building and community regeneration. He argues about community like this, about regenerating community like this. He says, each of us has a map of the social world in our mind, and the way we act, our plans and our opinions are the result of that map. The people who make social policy also have social maps in their minds. They make plans and design programs based upon their maps. Indeed, if you carefully examine their programs, you can detect the nature of their mental maps. The main problem with the typical social policy map is that programs based upon its suppositions are increasingly ineffective and even counterproductive. So as I said earlier, we now have jails that teach people how to be better criminals, hospitals where people become sick whilst waiting to be cured of what they arrived for, and schools where people get worse and worse school reports every year. It's obvious upon the briefest reflection that the typical social policy map is inaccurate because it excludes a major social domain, the community. By community, we mean the social place used by family, friends, neighbours, neighbourhood associations, clubs, civic groups, local enterprises, churches, ethnic associations, synagogues, mosques, local unions, local government, and local media. In addition to being called the community, the social environment is also described as the informal sector, the unmanaged sector, and the associational sector. These areas are what John McKnight has concentrated on. And the book describes in much more detail than I'm able to now. I've been quoting numbers of passages from it, but the book constitutes a bold restatement of some of Illich's arguments, provided and illustrated by examples taken from McKnight's direct experience and the research that he has carried out as part of his academic work. All of this led him to found the Asset-Based Community Development Institute, taking what he's written about directly into the communities where he claims it will do good. So what is asset-based community development? It's based on the assets that are already found in the community, and it mobilises individuals, associations and institutions to come together to build on their assets, not to concentrate on their needs. So asset-based community development stands in direct contradiction or direct opposition to needs-based development. It begins with an extensive period of time spent identifying the assets of individuals, associations, and then institutions before they are then mobilised to work together to build on the identifiable assets of all involved. Then, these identified assets from an individual are matched with people or groups that have an interest or need in that asset. The key is to begin to use what is already in the community. In the past, when a person had a need, they went to their neighbourhood for assistance. But this has shifted today to the belief that the neighbour does not have the skills to help them, and therefore we must go to a professional for assistance. The welfare system today works in such a way that professionals have made clients and recipients of the poor, robbing them of the support from their neighbours who now think they are not skilled enough to help. This leads to the isolation of individuals. It leads to the breakdown of community. The poor begin to see themselves as people with special needs that can only be met by outsiders. But this can be changed through the ABCD process, McKnight claims. A second power of ABCD is found in the local associations who should drive the community development process and leverage additional support and entitlements. These associations are the vehicles through which all a community's assets can be identified and then connected to another in ways that multiply their power and effectiveness. Users of the ABCD approach are deliberate in their intentions to lead by stepping back. Existing associations and networks, whether formal or informal, are assumed to be the source of constructive energy in the community. Community-driven development is done rather than development driven by external agencies. ABCD draws out strengths and successes in a community's shared history as its starting point for change. Among all the assets that exist in the community, ABCD pays particular attention to the assets inherent in social relationships, as evident in formal and informal associations and networks. ABCD's community-driven approach is in keeping with the principles and practice of participatory approaches development, where active participation and empowerment and the active prevention of disempowerment are the basis of practice. It's a strategy directed towards sustainable economic development that is community-driven. Now, I will place links in the program page on the Meow website for this podcast, both to the book, The Curless Society, Community and Its Counterfeits, and to the website of the ABCD Institute, and to the pages on the website where they list the toolkits they have built and where you may download your own copies of them. I think what John McKnight is doing, and elderly as he is, he's still hard at work, I believe, what he's doing builds directly upon the theoretical work of Illich and the practical work that Illich conducted in Mexico and South America. And I think it serves as a beacon for those of us who want to pursue an optimistic approach to moving towards cultural democracy, who want to fight for rather than fight against. I'll leave you with those thoughts. Please try and find a copy of the book. There's a link to it on the Internet Archive on the website. Please try and read the book if you find it. It's still in print. It's still available via Amazon if you want a print copy, and maybe other places too. And please check out the ABCD Institute, where some of these ideas have been put into practice for 20 or more years. Thank you. Happy reading. Now that you've heard the podcast, you can go to the website to find out more details, including references and links. The website's at miaw.net. That's miaaw.net. See you there.